Okay, well, last time we finished up the book of Exodus. And in chapter 40, we saw that on the first day of the month of the first year after leaving Egypt, so about a year later, Moses set up the tabernacle. And under God's direction, Moses anointed it. He consecrated the items. They were set apart as holy to God. By God's words, when he looked at all of that and gave Moses the instructions, he said, "It shall be holy." When he talked about the altar and a few specific items, he said, "It will be most holy." And so God was setting aside the tabernacle build according to his instructions, now being erected by Moses on this first day of the first month. And God is setting it aside along with, by God's direction again, Aaron and his sons are set aside. They are washed. They are given the holy garments. They're placed on them. They're anointed and consecrated for service to God. And at the end of the chapter, we see some really, to me, what in my mind's eye, imagining what it would have been like, astounding moments. They had been led by the cloud, pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. I don't think they did a very good job of the people as a whole of understanding just what that meant and the significance of what they had with God's leadership and direction for them. They seemed to take it for granted, but here at the end of the book, that cloud covered the tent of the meeting. It says, "The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." And even Moses, with the glory of the Lord in the tabernacle, could not enter because of the cloud and the presence of God there. So this was even a step above what Moses had experienced in his many encounters with God. And it also said at the end of the chapter that going forward, the cloud was taken up, then they would set out. If the cloud was not taken up, then they remained, and they would not leave until that was the case. And it said in all their journeys, it was the cloud by day and the fire by night. And so we saw a pretty significant, positive conclusion to the book of Exodus that was said by the word, the scripture, that the people built the tabernacle under Moses' direction with the helpers as expected that had the skill, and they did just as God instructed. And that wasn't always the case, was it? There were many times that they were in rebellion. And so to pick up the story, we're going to continue by taking a look at the book of Numbers. And so I've got I have an introduction to Numbers that we can spend a little bit of time with here. I can't seem to get a little bit of out of my vocabulary this morning, but nonetheless, the name Numbers, as I was doing research to understand the background of the book and so on, the name Numbers actually is not the name that was typically used for it in the Hebrew-speaking people in days of old. The name Numbers was developed a couple of different times it was used, but primarily came from the Greek Septuagint, which was a translation done from the Hebrew to the Greek. There were 72 Jewish scholars. It was done about the 3rd century before Christ, which was a millennia after the events. The Septuagint was used by many early Christians because they didn't know Hebrew, but they did know Greek. There was also the Latin Vulgate translation that came in the late 300s post-Christ, when Latin was used a lot and was seen as the language that the Bible ought to be in. There's some items there that I'm not going to attempt to bring to mind and bring out, but In both cases, both when the Septuagint was translated as well as the folks that translated the Latin Vulgate version, they focused on numbers because of the census counting that was a big part of chapters 1 through 4, and then again in chapter 26 of the book of what we call Numbers today. So in the English world, English translations, we carry the name Numbers. The most common Hebrew name from the days of the Hebrews, it comes from, in the early part of the book, the wilderness, that this was a wilderness experience, and so they would have called it in the wilderness. It's the history of the Israelite time where they spent 39 years in the wilderness. They don't start right out with just wandering, but they'll get there and have that time of wandering before they actually successfully enter the promised land that was promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that God has been telling them they're on the way to inhabit, even giving them in their laws that we saw in the book of Exodus. When you're in the land, remember they were given laws specific to how they should be conducting themselves, how they should be administering their nation once they're in the land of Canaan and overtake it. The early church fathers, now we're talking church, so after Christ, but not very long, the early fathers, usually that's about that first 150 years or maybe 200 years that we'll call them an early church father. From the Hebrew, they had another title that they liked, and it was, "And he spoke," and the he, of course, was God. In verse 1:1 of Numbers, this is how it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses." And so that was a title that some put on the book in the early church fathers when the newly birthed Church of Christ, I don't mean that like our current Church of Christ, but the church established and founded by Christ's presence here on earth, they often would refer to this as the time that God spoke or the book that God spoke, which of course is accurate. It was written by Moses. That's very accepted throughout all of the era of the Hebrew time for the Jews up through the time of Christ. When Jesus would speak, he often said, referred to the Old Testament as Moses and the prophets. Clearly, Jesus accepted Moses' authorship of the first five books. Many Old Testament and New Testament references would indicate it was written by Moses. As a matter of fact, Numbers itself. Let's go over to Numbers 33, verse 2. Numbers 33, verse 2. And in there it says, "Moses recorded their starting places according to their journeys by the command of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their starting places." And so clearly they're indicating this was Moses' work. Toward the end of the book, we're close to the end already, but if you go over to chapter 36, verse 13, there it says, and it's the actual closing of the book, the last verse, "These are the commandments and the ordinance which the Lord commanded to the sons of Israel through Moses in the places, in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho." And so very clearly, Numbers itself sees Moses as the one who was presenting it to the people and then writing it down as well. Without much doubt, it was written near the end of Moses' life, which was somewhere later than 1400 BC. You know, you have to count backwards if you're in the BC range, so probably somewhere in the high 1300s BC, Moses' life would end. So it was written before that, but not much before that. It concentrates in two eras of the time of the Israelites and their trek to and taking of the Promised Land. The second year, there's a lot in Numbers about the second year of their trek, which started the first day of the second year was when Moses erects the tabernacle according to God's instruction at the end of the book of Exodus. So from there, there's a lot of information about that first year after they leave Sinai with the tabernacle as a part of their direct life. And then it spends a lot of time in the 40th year, the last year of their trek after the time of the Exodus, when they're waiting those years out where God commanded that the Israelite people would wander for a generational change until those people had passed on. And the absence or quietness about the middle years, many say, is more than just a hint of how wasted those years were. It was, I mean, what are you going to write about wandering? We got up today and we wandered around again. And our clothes were still usable and we went to bed. I mean, it's just, there just wasn't a lot to say about their wandering outside of some eventful moments in that wandering. And so that's an introduction to Numbers. Not that those middle years aren't mentioned at all. I don't want to insinuate that. But the concentration's at about the beginning of that time in the book and the end of that time. So with that, let's go over to the book of Numbers and start into that a little bit. All right, I'm doing it again. I don't know where that phrase came from. I'm going to have to study that out. There's something that I worked for years on getting rid of. Didn't manage it 100%, but did diminish it a lot. Maybe I can diminish that little bit of it if I think about it. So first of all, let's look at Numbers 1:1-4, and let me read that. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting on the first of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, who as ever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies. With you, moreover, there shall be a man of each tribe, each one the head of his father's household." And then in verse 5, it starts talking about those names. And so the Lord God commands Moses, take a census. Now, it's not just a census, is it? It's really the beginning of forming the people by their tribal heritage into armies. And so they are going to look at men who are 20 years old and older, who are capable of being soldiers, and they are going to be numbered, and we'll know how many there are. So I handed out this sheet this morning. If we began in verse 5, we could read through this, but I'm, as I told you last time, going to take a little bit more of a survey approach. And for presentation this morning, it looked a lot easier for me to condense this to something we can look at together that is written. And to start with, let's take a look. We're not going to go over and read Genesis 29 and following, the chapter 29 and some of 30, maybe even some of 31, I don't remember. We're not going to go read that. But if you read through that, we get a listing at that point of the offspring, the sons of Jacob, whose other name is Israel. This is where their Israelite name comes from. And here are the sons listed by their order of birth. And if you remember going through Genesis, there was this competitive spirit between Leah and Rachel. And the way they felt about it, by their own words, They made it clear that when they were giving birth to a son for Jacob, they felt like they were the loved one. And when the other wife was giving birth, they felt out of favor. And Leah has the privilege of getting that competition started. And so the first four children were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And their mother was Leah. And then Rachel, perceiving that she is remaining barren, offers up as a substitute mother, not uncommon in that era or that time period, Bilhah, her maid servant. And so she is giving birth in behalf of Rachel. And Dan and Naphtali are born to Bilhah. Leah decides she wants to get back in on the competitive race. And so she offers up her maidservant, Zilpah, and Gad and Asher are born to Zilpah. And then Leah gives birth herself to Issachar and Zebulun. And to finish out the time of Rachel's wife role with Jacob, she gives birth to Joseph. And then some years later, they have moved. They have left their father. You know, they were living with the wife's father and tending his flocks and so on. But Benjamin is born, and Rachel dies in the birth of Benjamin. And so these become the 12 sons of Jacob. Now, when we get to Numbers in chapter 1, 5 through 16, that we didn't read, but I listed them in the order that they're listed. They're in Numbers, and who they are being represented by. And the order there starts out very similar to birth order, but that's not the order it really is. So they list Reuben, and then Simeon, and then Judah, and Issachar, and Zebulun. And then we get Ephraim and Manasseh, who were both sons of Joseph. And they're in this list individually. And then we get Benjamin, and then Dan, Asher, Gad, and Naphtali. Now this is in the list that is first recorded by Moses, saying, they told us to go take a census. They're going to do that. But God had told them there will be a representative, essentially the head of that tribe, will come and be a part of taking this census with you. And this is the list of sons and how they were divided up. And yes, there are two there for Joseph. There's somebody missing. Who's missing from the list? Levi. And we know why, don't we? Or at least we'll find out again. They'll tell us again in the book of Numbers. But the Levites have an entirely different role. They are the priestly family. And so that shows us the order that they're talked about with regard to this census that will be taken. Now, there's some things on the other side of this page that we'll get to in just a minute. Now, remember there in verse 1, it said that it was the first of the second month of the second year after leaving Egypt. So how long has the tabernacle been up? A month. A month, because this is the first of the second month. And so they spent a month there on Mount Sinai area where the tabernacle was up. And obviously the pillar of cloud was staying in the tabernacle day by day by day. And so this comes up at the beginning of that second year. And who is given the responsibility of making the census? We find it there in verse 3. Who's going to do that? Aaron along with Moses. They're making obvious preparations. What are they making preparations for? War. When they leave Mount Sinai, they are leaving, having begun at least, the preparations for how they would handle themselves in armed conflict. I said armed. don't know to what level they were armed, but certainly conflict, army style, who can serve in a war type situation. And of course, these men are assigned to help them with the process of doing the census, and God names them by tribe as to who's going to be involved in making that all work and work well. Now, an interesting thing when we look at Ephraim and Manasseh there about Joseph, back in Genesis 48, I'm not going to ask you to turn there right now, Joseph is presenting his two sons that have been born to him in Egypt. And he presents them to Jacob, and he's looking for Jacob's blessing, which Jacob gives. Do you remember what was peculiar about the way Jacob gave the blessing? Crossed his hands. Joseph had presented the two boys, so the eldest son, I've got some other crowded things in my notes here, but which was Manasseh, he had put him on Jacob's right, so he would get the right-hand blessing, which was considered the more special of the blessing. But Jacob crossed his hands, and Joseph tries to correct that, and Jacob says, no, this is right, that the younger Ephraim was to be the greater of the two. He said, now Manasseh will be great as well, but Ephraim is to be the greater of the two. And so Jacob goes on to tell him that Joseph is going to get a double portion in the inheritance. This is partly how that double portion happens. Not in the whole inheritance, and I didn't write down the exactness, but there was a portion of the inheritance that Jacob said they would get a double portion for. So, did we not get that shut tight, Steve?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm running them out over there. I'm sorry about that. Thanks for fixing that for us. Those two fill in the gap that is made by Levi not being in the list. And Ephraim is the one that will be the greater of the two, but both are in the list. Now, if we read through the next passage, let me go down and read chapter 1, verses 47 through 54. Turn the page. Because then it goes through and talks about all of them being numbered. You know, I'm not going to do that yet, because it's still in before those verses that we get the numbers. So if you turn over to the back, the one by the color, I about got that out of order there. When they do the counts, they're all relisted again. Well, interestingly enough, the order is by mother with one exception. So let's just look at the order for fun for a minute. I don't know what to make of it, if anything special. I want to turn this over. So when we look at the order of their birth order, we can see who the mothers are out there. And if we go down through Zebulun, those are Leah's children with one exception. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Because who was Levi born to? Leah. And Levi's not going to be in the list, is he? So we'll look at that exception in a moment. And then Ephraim and Manasseh represent Joseph, as does Benjamin, children, direct children of Rachel. And then they mix up the ones born by the handmaidens. They just put them in a list there. But it's Dan, Asher, Naphtali, and Gad. But Gad gets elevated up into that third spot. I don't know if elevated is the right word, But he's listed in with Leah's children. Well, Gad was born to the firstborn, to Zilpah, Leah's handmaiden. So Gad moves into the list of Leah's group. I mean, the numbers doesn't make anything about this, so I don't know if I should. But they keep changing the order in which they list them. When they finally get down to the census numbers, they list them by which mother they were, with the exception of Gad, who gets moved out of the handmaiden list up into Leah's list there at the top. And when you turn a page over, that'll work better. And they listed out how many fighting men they had in each one of the categories, each of the tribes. And the total comes out to 603,550 men. That gets tossed around between the various, they would call themselves scholars, I don't know that I would like to for a certain group anyway. They get tossed around like, well, that wasn't the real number. What do you mean that wasn't the real number? I mean, this kind of an argument gets going. And so they try to talk about, well, in the time that the Jacob and his family were in Egypt, how many years was that? Well, it's actually 430, because they go clear back in the scriptures, they go clear back to the time that Joseph was there earlier too. So either way you can look at it, the scriptures tell us the whole family was there 400 years. When they talk about it in Exodus chapter 12, they say it was 430 years. And we're going to read some of those verses real quick in just a moment. But they start saying that that's too many. You can't get that big in that length of time. And I want to address some of that with some scriptures. First of all, I want to go back to Exodus 1. And I thought about not reading all this passage, but I think it really needs to be read. And I'm going to read verses 8 through 22. Exodus 1, 8 through 22. This is an interesting testimony about the quantity of people in Israel. Now a new king arose over Egypt, beginning in Exodus 1:8. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithon and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Then the kings of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shapira, and the other was named Puah. And he said, "When you are helping the Hebrew women give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them." So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive." So what did Pharaoh think about those Israelites and their quantity. They were vast. I don't know how literally to take his words, but literally in verse, I'm going to turn back a page. In verse 9, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, if we take that literally, I don't know if Pharaoh meant it literally, but he's essentially saying, they came here, but now there's more of them than there is of us. And yet people want to say, oh, it just wasn't possible for them to have become this prolific, that they would have 600,000 fighting men. Because if you think about 600,000 fighting men, not counting the Levites, you're looking at a population, if you figured a family of three or four with each one, I mean, you're in the millions of these people that were making the Exodus. And we've been through some of this before, but I just wanted to reemphasize that as we look at this number. And I've got a few more factors to bring in, but first, let's go to Exodus 12, 41. Exodus 12, 41. And I could just tell you what this verse says. It might be just as effective, but I want to read it to you. This is at the time of their leaving Egypt. And it says, and it's at the moment they're leaving, it says, at the end of 430 years to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So there was 430 years transpired between the time of the beginning of Joseph in Egypt, probably is what that 430 means, and the time of the beginning of the Exodus. Now, I want to bring one more thing in. Let's go to Let's go to Exodus 7, 7. Because I want to put some years together. Exodus 7, 7. Well, turn some more pages. And it says, Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. So Moses has been born and he grew up enough that he killed an Egyptian taskmaster and took off and found himself over in the Sinai Desert area, area of Midian, gained a wife. God speaks to him in a burning bush and sends him back to rescue the people. And God puts Aaron with him to be a spokesperson to help through the speech moments. And so when they're confronting Pharaoh, Moses is 80. Things must have been different, weren't they? I feel old at 67. But here he is at 80 in front of Pharaoh. And if we assume that that's the same year that they left Egypt, this is the 430th year, right? So Moses was born in the 350th year of the time of the Israelites in Egypt. Are you with me? In the 350th year, Pharaoh was already saying, there's too many of them. And we're talking 80 years later. And we get a testimony right out of the Word that says the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. And so, is it any wonder that by the time we get here, doesn't it make sense that there would be a lot of fighting men available, that it would be a couple million people out traversing around? Because Pharaoh's talking for all of Egypt, and he says there's more of them than there is us. if you take it literally. To be fair, when we look at that list of numbers, and you look at it, are there any in the ones column? I'd have hated to have been the 46,501st, because they said, no, you can't count. We're going to stick with zeros at the end. You can see there must have been a little bit of, I don't think God intentionally set that up, so probably a little bit of rounding here or something. I don't know. They all end in zero, so that kind of brings a little bit of a question. Wasn't any of them that wasn't by even tens? But they in the tens column, we don't have any. But in the hundreds column, we do. So maybe it's to the nearest hundred that they listed. I don't know. There's also an argument made that when they said these numbers, they didn't really mean 46,000. They meant 46 clans. That's silly. And I'll tell you why that's silly. And you add it all up, you wouldn't get 603,550 men. You'd get 603.5 clans. The very language of the Bible just takes away the idea that it's some sort of other unit than actual numbers like we would use numbers. And so when they do the accounting, they come up with 603,550 men. They add it up there. They put the number in. It pretty well eliminates all of the arguments that these weren't just really truly numbers. Questions, comments?
Yeah, Rick, I just wanted to make a point. We ascribe to the literal, grammatical, historical hermeneutic. And so if you ascribe to that, you take the plain, literal meaning of the text, any context, take into account authorial intent, and how the readers would understand it.
Yep.
So the plain meaning of this text is those numbers.
Exactly.
And so what you have is a lot of scholars who have departed from that and try and spiritualize numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I think when Moses wrote that, if you read this, the plain meaning of the text is those exact numbers. What he meant, and that's how the Israelites would have read it.
Yep.
And so if you stick with that hermeneutic, the understanding is plain, easy, simple, and makes sense.
Yeah, and I was saving one point I wanted to make. All of the discussion I've had so far has been about the hermeneutics, and certainly that is how we approach it, just the way Dave said it. How do we interpret this text? The other piece of this that comes in is those scholars want to go, it couldn't be that many. They do the math and say, you can't add up that many people with that few generations. Well, other scholars say, yes, you can. But what are all the people leaving out?
God can do anything.
And that's what we would not want to leave out of this discussion about how many people were there. If God wanted 50 million Israelites by the time they left, he'd have had it. And it had added up to that. And if he wanted 50 million and one, that's what would have been there. So this is a testimony of what God was doing in the land of Egypt. And the more that the Egyptian leadership tried to put them down, what did the Bible itself say? The more they multiplied. And so when we boil it all down, it's so easy to start reading the various this idea versus that idea and get caught up in man's logic with it, which isn't all bad, because we want to make the best sense out of it, but the best sense doesn't come from what some, you don't pick the theory that you think is the best. You go with what the scripture says, and then you use that as evidence to say, what does that teach you? And what that teaches us is that even while they were slaves, God was blessing them and was in control of them. What God told Abraham was, those that bless you, I will bless. Those that curse you, I will curse. That started with Abraham. And it didn't stop while they were in Egypt. As a matter of fact, Joseph got it right What you brothers of mine meant for evil, God meant for good. Even the slavery was a part of God's blessing them. It was out of their slavery they came out as a nation, unified. They couldn't go back to Egypt, could they? They were going. God wanted them to go. God wanted their focus set on that. They struggled with God a little bit. There it is. They struggled with God in working out what it meant to follow God and being totally in subjection to Him and even rejoicing in those difficult moments, because it was in those difficult moments that they got to see God in His great might and power there for their benefit. But the same thing's true about these numbers. So God prospered them and put them together in a great way as a nation coming up out of Egypt. Let's look at numbers. Any questions or comments?
I just wanted to say too, I think all these worldviews are connected. As we were going through Exodus, mm-hmm. we talked about the Reed Sea interpretation of the old, that particular passage. That's connected in conjunction with that same interpretation of these numbers being fewer, mainly because the modernist controversy of the early 20th century shed doubt on the supernatural, all things supernatural. And so if we throw out the supernatural, we can throw out basically any kind of interpretation. And so it's just important that we understand. I think we still even see a little bit of this today, because there's a lot of talk about how do we grow the church? How do we do this different stuff? Mm-hmm. And really what we do is we jettison the supernatural work of the Spirit in favor of these pragmatic approaches. You know, I shouldn't share the gospel with them. I really just need to befriend them. I need to do this kind of stuff. And what we do is we shed light on that supernatural aspect of the Lord establishing His numbers, frustrating the plans of the wicked despite what we think.
So. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And you know, you said it. I'm going to add to it just a little bit. What do they want to take out of the gospel or out of the scriptures? They want to take out the supernatural. Well, that means that what they really want is they want God out. They replace God with something. If you think about it a minute, they don't just want God out. What do they want to replace God with?
Science.
Themselves. They want to be the judges of Scripture rather than letting the Scripture, and tell what the truth is, determine what the truth is, rather than letting the truth be told to them and be judged by God. And that's really what it's all about. Let's go over to chapter 1 again, and let's start with verse 47 and read through 54. The Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribe, for the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all of its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it. They shall also camp around the tabernacle, so that when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down, and when the tabernacle encamps, the Levites shall set it up. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death. The sons of Israel shall camp each man by his own company, by his own camp, and each man by his own standard, according to their armies. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, so that there will be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all that which the Lord had commanded Moses. So they did." So we get the passage here. It says, God directly said, don't number the Levites. By God's command in 48 and 49 and verses 50 and 51, the Levites have responsibility for the tabernacle. It's tear down and it's set up. And that any layman, that's the way the New American Standard says it, comes near is to be put to death. And other versions say stranger or outsider or unauthorized or anyone else, and there's a few others probably. I looked at what the Hebrew word might tend to be meaning in its first read, and they say stranger or another is the two primary meanings of the Hebrew word. we can see why they went to Laman, can't we? The Levites are the priestly clan, right? They're not the layman like we would talk about layman today. They're the workers of the temple, of the tabernacle. And so that's their responsibility. And other people are not authorized by God to get involved. And so God says, if somebody else comes in and tries to take it down or put it up or handle it, what's supposed to be done to them?
Death.
And does God say, I'll kill them? No, I think that would be up to the people to do. It is interesting let's see if I can see the verses. Oh, never mind, it's coming, so I'll get there. And so what are the Levites to do with regard to when the group, the whole nation, stops to camp somewhere? They are to camp around the tabernacle. Yeah, well, it's easy to do that. And so they are going to be encircling the tabernacle area in their own camping. And why? So there will be no wrath on the congregations of the sons of Israel. They're a border, if you will, between all of the rest of the nation and its encampment. So people won't inadvertently wander in or do something, whatever. They're there to be that buffer zone, as well as to protect the tabernacle, as well as to just be the ones that do their job and thus avoid the wrath of God falling down on the whole peoples because it isn't done that way. Verse 54, I find to be too rare in the books of Exodus and Numbers. And that is this: the sons of Israel did according to all that which the Lord had commanded them, had commanded Moses. So they did. How much brighter their testimony and their joy as a nation would be if that was the key verse of their existence. But it wasn't. But we're starting off on a really good foot. You know, if you look back at Exodus and all of the things that had happened in Exodus and their rebellions and their fears and their, did you bring us out here to die? Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? And all those statements. When Moses comes down off of the mountain, the second 40-day period, they did just what Moses told them to do, and Moses told them to do just what God told them to do, and the tabernacle is constructed, it's erected in just the way it was supposed to be, and God was pleased, and God's glory came down with the cloud and filled the tabernacle, and he was with them by cloud during the day and fire at night from there forward. Great place to be. It's like there was a big reset, and they're doing okay for right now. They made it a whole month. They were over. The tabernacle went up a month later. They're doing the census, and they're following what God asked them to do, and they're not done with that yet. God is asking them to do a number of things. In verse 52, it talks about that the Israelites are to camp with their banner or with their group. And so the Israelites are going to organize themselves by God's direction on where to camp and where to set that up. And let's look at Exodus 2, 1 through 5. We probably got just enough time to cover chapter 2, believe it or not, in 6 minutes. Let me read Exodus 2, 1 through 5. And we'll look at a few other verses, but we're not going to read them all. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, the sons of Israel shall camp each by his own standard with the banners of their father's households. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah, by their armies, and the leader of the sons of Judah, Nashon, the sons of Amminadab, and his army, even their numbered men, 74,600. Those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Issachar, and the leader of the sons of Issachar, Nethanel, the son of Zuar, and his army, even their numbered men, 54,400. And I'm not going to read all of those tribes, but they're going to be instructed on which side to camp. And on the east, where the sun comes up, you've got the little drawing here, and I want to talk about this drawing a little bit. But on the east side, where the sun comes up, you get Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. On the north, you can see that we get Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. And then on the west, Benjamin, Manasseh, and Ephraim. And then to the south, Gad, Simeon, and Reuben. And so God lays out which armies are going to be on which sides. Now, there are some assumptions in this drawing. Why did I pick this drawing? Because I was struggling with how to get two columns on the page and trying to find something that would fit that was still readable. So this one won, okay? I wasn't interested in trying to manufacture that drawing myself. The tribes may or may not have been side by side. They may have been out and form a kind of a cross shape where they go out. And so that could be. The other thing is, who's supposed to camp around? Because these are told by God at a distance. Who fills that distance in between these tribes and the tabernacle?
The Levites.
In this drawing, the person that put it together made it some assumptions about the sons of Aaron and how this would get divided up. And so they're saying which specific portions of the grouping of the Levites would be on the east, north, south. If it's in the scriptures, I haven't found it yet. Okay? I don't see anything in the scriptures that ever tells us about that division. Maybe it's there, but I haven't found it yet. Okay? That's just where I'm at. So I would tend to not get too hung up on this, but it makes it easier to see you got a north group, a south group, an east group, and a west group, and you've got the Levites all around. And so God lays out, this is where you're going to camp. Notice the wording, by their armies. God's directions here are already shifting toward the military posture. They're obviously going to have their families there and so on, but part of the context, part of the thought process is we're camped by armies. Verse 17, I want to look at that for just a moment. It says, "Then the tent of the meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps, just as they camp, so they shall set out every man in his place by their standards." That's the only thing I've found so far that says the Levites also have standards, meaning banners, labels, it says what it says. And so that would give a little bit of impetus toward they would do it by these groups that you see here. But there's nothing in here that says, and this one's on the north, and this one's on the west, and so on. So that's the little bit that I could find that said the Levites would also be grouped up within the Levites. Now, if you find it, I'm certainly... I mentioned this to Dave last week afterwards. I really appreciated what he brought, because I pray every week, Lord, you fill in the blanks. I got too many of them. I've got gaps, things I don't know. So if you find that somewhere, I'd be pleased to hear about it, and please don't hesitate to bring it up. I'm not the know-it-all here. Matter of fact, I'm the know-it-not-at-all here. Yeah, Dave?
Yeah, it's actually in Numbers chapter
3. 3?
Uh-huh.
How did I miss that?
333?
Well, thank you. Oh, it is there. I did several searches and I didn't read the whole book of Numbers looking for it, but I did not find that. That's where it's laying out the priesthood. So thank you. Appreciate that. Verse And that's good. Thank you. So this is consistent with what's there. I just didn't find it. I have to think about that a little bit, how I'm going at that. In verse 32, chapter 2, not 3, in verse 32, it once again talks about that total number. The wording of there is emphasis on armies again. In verse 33, it goes back to the Levites again and say they were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just like the Lord had commanded Moses. So we see that differentiation come out. And then verse 32. Nope, sorry. That's not 32. Verse 34 is what I was trying to get to. Because this is a fun thing to see a pattern with with the people of Israel. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses, so they camped by their standards, and so they set out every one by his family according to his father's household. And so once again we get to conclude a chapter with, and they did what God told them to do. And that just doesn't happen enough. It's nice to see a pattern of it here, at least at the beginning of the book of Numbers. Questions, comments, thoughts? Well, and that's an easy thing to say, but I think the tribes would disagree with you on days of battle. And I'm not trying to make fun of it. I'm just saying in the daily life of the camp, when they're moving, of course, the Levites were moving too. I mean, they had a lot of work to do. And they had daily worship work to do, and they had a lot to do.
It looks like to me that they were the ones that if anybody else outside of them would touch anything, that you know they would be killed. Well, the Levites would be the ones that have to kill them, wouldn't they?
Oh no, that's not. I wouldn't say that. Oh. I would say the whole rest of the camp, anybody in the camp that was involved with that, I would think that would be a national response, because I think I don't know how much to read into that, but. I would think God would bring judgment on the whole nation if they ignored his rules about this. You know, so if one of the tribe of Dan went over and came back and bragged about what he did, and the tribe of Dan didn't take their own man out, I think God would have been quick to judge. So, anything else? All right. Yes, sir.
And so that's why they were camped around the tabernacle, completely around it. That was God's space.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Good. Anything else? All right. Well, chapter 3 next time.